From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how the evolving economic climate is affecting the retirement and financial services firm, TIAA.
Later, the heroine in Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan's new novel, Dreams of Paris, and then one day finds herself there.
What does it mean when a place like Paris or the life you thought you were going to lead doesn't exactly turn out to square with that? How do you navigate the gap between the reality and myth that you had? I think it's one of the things that really obsesses her in the book.
And Robert Cohen prepares to perform all of Johann Sebastian Bach's six suites for unaccompanied cello in one evening.
It is a journey. I mean, each suite is kind of further up the hill, and the sixth suite is really extraordinarily complex and fiendishly difficult to play.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're just a couple of weeks away from the date underlined in red for many people. That's the day income tax returns are due to the federal and state governments. Hopefully, you've been planning throughout the year so that the bottom line on your tax returns won't come as too much of a surprise.
The tax and regulatory environment has been changing a lot over the past year and a half in this country. For Roger Ferguson, the changes are affecting both his company and the people it serves. Ferguson is CEO of TIAA, the retirement and financial services firm that largely serves people in education and in nonprofit sectors. Ferguson was in Milwaukee recently, and we caught up with him then. Thank you for taking a few minutes to speak with us.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
TIAA was founded and run for a long time as a nonprofit. It has gone through changes in more recent years. How do you see the evolution of the company since you have been running it?
Well, the evolution of the company has two components. One is things that have changed, and one is things that have not changed. So what has not changed is that we still have our not-for-profit heritage, and our charter calls for us to operate in that fashion. We still are primarily focused on providing financial well-being for individuals and the not-for-profit sector. What has changed is we are building out capabilities that include retirement, which is our core service, but adding more, including banking, life insurance. Here in Wisconsin, we are involved in the 529 program, for example. And so what really has evolved over time is we've become a more of a full-service financial services firm, but with the same culture, the same heritage, the same values, and the same history.
And still geared largely towards working with people in the nonprofit world?
Still absolutely geared towards folks in the not-for-profit world, higher education, medical, cultural, and research. That's our home base.
The watchword in the financial and really many other industries in the last couple of years has been uncertainty. How much more certainty do you have now about the economic and tax climate after 14 months of the current administration and the way the economy is shaping up?
I think the watchword is always change. So there has been greater certainty around tax law because that's now been signed into law. But the places of uncertainty have to do with what looks like now a very positive macroeconomic environment. But one always has to be aware that the markets have been very, very strong for almost a decade now. And so many of us are observing and asking sort of questions around how long that's going to last. Personally, I think we've got some way to go in terms of reasonably good stock market performance, but we have seen an uptick in volatility of late. And so I'd say this is the time to be optimistic that good times will continue, but one should not be complacent.
I don't know exactly how old you are, but certainly as I was coming of age, the idea of planning for retirement was a salient one, seemingly no matter what your social strata was. I don't necessarily know that I see that from my view anymore. What are you seeing in terms of current attitudes towards saving for retirement among different generations?
I think you put your finger on it by saying it varies from generation to generation. For those of us who are older and aging baby boomers, we are now entering retirement, and so retirement is really front and center in our thinking. For the millennials, I think they are focused on getting started. They have a number of financial issues and challenges. In some cases, it's student debt. Others are, you know, getting married and starting a household. But those who have jobs, I would absolutely encourage them to put saving for retirement as one of the things that they're focused on, because they will eventually get to a place where they're going to need those retirement savings. For those that are in the middle, I've observed that they are also focused on, as we aging baby boomers are, starting the process of saving for retirement as they're getting, you know, other parts of their financial lives in order.
You know, given the mission of TIAA and it's so many, it's multiple connections with higher education institutions, I imagine you have cause to meet younger people who are either in college or just getting out of college. And I wonder what you hear from them, the kinds of questions that they ask you most often.
Well, indeed, I do have cause to talk to younger people. I was just on the campus of the University of Wisconsin of Madison recently, and I heard a number of things. One is they are very interested in what are the lessons that we in the older generation can give them about their financial lives. So they are curious about that, contrary to what many people might say as a generalization. Secondly, they recognize the value of education. Again, I am talking to people who are on college campuses. And they're all also very interested in, you know, careers, career projections, how one develops a career and moves forward. So I'm very optimistic from the conversations I'm hearing with young people on campuses.
How were your own attitudes about retirement shaped by your upbringing?
I was very, very lucky to grow up in a household that valued both education and financial literacy. But one of the things I saw, particularly with my father, was saving and investing with a long-term perspective, knowing that retirement would be looming in the future, was an important lesson. And indeed, my father was very financially literate, didn't have much money, but he managed to actually take an early retirement from his job and lived on his own resources in retirement for almost 30 years.
Do I remember reading, was he a cartographer?
Yes, my father was a cartographer, a civilian map maker for the U.S. Army.
Well, and there seems to be something about that world that you know, when you are drawing maps for a living, you have to be able to understand the connections from one thing to another.
Absolutely. My father was very, very analytical. And as you point out, the ability to sort of see those kinds of connections carried over into him being very, very interested in financial matters as well. Very logical, very grounded, and very analytical.
There's a reason that roadmap is a metaphor.
Exactly right.
Can you share a little bit about your own path to the place that you are today and what lessons people might draw from it?
Sure. The first thing I would share is my path was not predictable or direct. And so I always tell people that there's no such thing as a career ladder. It's more like a rock climbing wall or the, you know, the children's jungle gym out in the playground. You move left, you move right, you move up, you move down. So my career, I think, reflects that kind of uncertainty. The second element of my career that I think is relevant is it's really built around the amount of time I spent in higher ed. And so, you know, the other big lesson for me is you can build a very interesting, diverse 30, maybe 40-year career built off of making sure you invest in your own education up front.
Oh, I was just going to ask, and is there a certain amount of keeping your eyes open to those other handholds that you have to do?
Oh, absolutely. The way I describe that is a career is also involved in taking reasonable risks, you know, looking for those other handholds in a rock climbing wall analogy. And so being open to those opportunities when they present themselves, but making sure you're qualified to be successful. And that goes back to the issue of having ample education and building what we economists are called your own human capital.
Did I also remember reading correctly that is it true that you cleaned bathrooms while you were in college?
Yes, it is. So my work-study job for the first 2 years in college was cleaning bathrooms. It was not in any sense a glamorous job. But the lesson I learned from that is that there is no job that is so small that you wouldn't want to do it well. And that's another thing that I've taken with me on my journey through my career over the last 40 years or so.
The bathrooms at Harvard were not nicer than any bathrooms anywhere else.
Bathrooms are bathrooms, and you can imagine bathrooms that are used by college students are probably a lot less nice than other bathrooms.
I don't really want to imagine them
no,
at all, actually.
Yes, exactly right.
What about the lessons about leadership that you have gotten from others play into what you're able to accomplish today?
I think the main lessons I've learned about leadership is that leadership is really about exciting and attracting followers. And so one has to say, what are the skills that it takes to really bring followers along behind you? And I see four things. One is you have to have expertise. Individuals don't follow an amateur. Secondly, you have to be able to describe where you want to go and articulate that well in a compelling way. The third thing I think is often surprising to people is I've seen the best leaders are very empathetic. You know, if you're going to work with other human beings and want them to follow you, you have to understand where they're coming from. And recognize that they're just not cogs in your vision or your machine, but they've got their lives of their own. And the final element of leadership is around a certain amount of fortitude. The path is almost never straight. There are setbacks. And individuals don't want to follow a leader who is the first one to panic as soon as things don't go smoothly.
The number of African Americans running financial services firms is fairly low. Does that concern you? And are there things that you do to try to change that?
It absolutely is something I think should be of concern to all of us in the sense that we know that diversity and inclusion throughout an organization, including diverse perspectives at the top of the organization, can often lead to better outcomes and better changes and better solutions. And secondly, we understand that we live in a world that's really becoming more and more diverse, and so it's important for all businesses to reflect that. What I try to do to deal with that is to be, one, forthright about this as an issue. Two, hopefully I can serve as a bit of a role model, and I do spend a fair amount of my time on college campuses trying to interact with all sorts of students to indicate to everybody just by my presence that you know, leadership comes in all sorts of shapes, sizes, and colors.
At some point, do you stop noticing when you walk in the room that there are really not very many leaders of color?
I don't think that you ever really stop noticing that. The question is then, how do you react to it? And my view is, you react to it by being the best leader you can possibly be. If you happen to be the only person of color in the room, then I think your job is to continue to do the best you can. You don't have to take the burden for the entire race, and you shouldn't feel, I think, in any sense stymied by being the only person of color in the room. The way I think about it is a relevant factor, but it's not the only factor.
Roger Ferguson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Roger Ferguson is CEO of the financial services firm TIAA. We spoke with him while he was in Milwaukee to speak at an event organized by the Lubar School of Business at UW-Milwaukee.
Tensions continue to mount between Russia and the United States. A nerve agent attack on a former spy in the UK, expelled diplomats on both sides, nuclear missile testing. It all brings back memories of the Cold War.
Lake Effect SAS Art Sear says we need to put all of this into context.
Reflecting now firmly established tradition, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has delivered his own version of a State of the Union address to his people. His speech in early March dealt to a substantial degree with the challenges of economic growth and modernization. Putin's speech is the latest installment of the annual address formally titled the Presidential Address to the Federal Assembly. The custom dates back to the early 1990s and the turbulent regime of President Boris Yeltsin. Putin took over national power at the turn of the century and essentially has maintained control ever since. Significantly, considerable media attention is devoted to his statements regarding the current and future development of nuclear weapons, including advanced technologically exotic offensive weapons and a new generation of cruise missiles. His tone was combative, and the rhetoric clearly aggressive, even if there was nothing especially new in the substance of his remarks. This is not surprising, given the increasing tensions between Moscow and Washington, D.C., current preoccupation in the United States with confirmed Russian meddling in the 2016 elections has greatly increased hostile sentiments ranging from anxiety to alarm. In fact, President Barack Obama called attention to this meddling before voting took place. Today's media commentators and reporters, and of course our politicians, tend to overlook that point. Our current demonization of Russia is one understandable result. The latest partisan-driven effort to try to link criminal activity directly to the White House and President Donald Trump, a legacy of the Watergate scandals of the 1970s, feeds the general obsession with Russia. Ignored in all this intense political heat is the degree to which Putin's speech addressed economic rather than military matters. He admitted that Russia's position remains weak. While the government halted decline and is taking significant steps to promote investment and infrastructure, the economy remains vulnerable. Russia's president employs autocratic and at times ruthless tactics. That reflects both absence of democratic practices and tradition and the clear preferences of those in charge. Putin deserves credit for stabilizing an economy in freefall when he took over. Russia was literally disintegrating in tangible terms. Public suffering was growing at an alarming rate, and total collapse was imminent. Even though the government averted disaster, Russia remains essentially a developing country, plagued with corruption, lack of investment, and basic dependence on petroleum. On the military side, Putin emphasized the important decision of President George W. Bush to withdraw from the 1972 ABM, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, as partial justification for new weapons development. This treaty complemented another limiting the numbers of strategic missile launchers on both sides. The two SALT I Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties are capstone diplomatic achievements of President Richard Nixon and advisor, later Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Moscow historically gave greater attention than the U.S. to defense, but that changed. In the early 1960s, Kennedy administration Defense Secretary Robert McNamara emphasized offensive missiles. He rejected the anti-ballistic missile as impractical and too easily overwhelmed. Later, President Lyndon Johnson forced McNamara to declare support for an ABM system. President Ronald Reagan gave priority to exotic space-based missile interceptors, termed the Strategic Defense Initiative. The Air Force became the leading service, but the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff endorsed the effort. Emphasis on advanced technology greatly increased fears and spending in the Soviet Union. Putin's speech directly reflects this Cold War history, along with Russia's traditional insecurities about security. Russia remains weak, while Americans overreact as usual.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is the director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Buying a struggling English language bookstore in Paris might not be a plan suggested by a financial advisor, but that's what a fictional Milwaukeean does in a new novel by writer Liam Callanan. We'll talk with him about Paris by the Book when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If there are any themes that fiction readers have warmed to in recent years, they would include Paris and bookshops, sometimes bookshops in Paris.
But none of them have woven Milwaukee into that mix, well, until now. Wisconsin novelist Liam Callanan's new novel features a Milwaukee woman married to a writer who suddenly goes missing. She and her two adolescent children go looking for him, a journey that leads them to buy a bookshop in Paris.
What do they find? Well, that is contained in the pages of the novel Paris by the Book, which is out tomorrow. Liam Callanan, who is an occasional Lake Effect essayist, joins us in the studio today to offer a preview. Liam Callanan, great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thanks. It's been a fun ride so far.
Well, good. as it should be, I would hope. When did you first go to Paris?
I first went to Paris when I was in college. And it left a wonderful impression on me, of course. But I didn't get back to Paris until years later with my family. And so I think the first time that I was able to go with my kids, it was probably in 2012 or thereabouts. And like many Milwaukee families, we looked up come springtime and realized that we needed to definitely have a spring break. And I was looking at flights to Florida and hotels there, and they were awfully expensive. And then I saw a Paris flight advertised come across, and I said, wait a second, we could go to Paris for less than it would cost to go to Florida. And the truth was, we could go for much less. And so I redirected our efforts, and off we went to Paris. And the weather was exactly like it is on the east side of Milwaukee where we live. It was cold and wet and rainy, but it was wonderful. And my girls were captivated by the city. And we wandered around town exploring nooks and crannies, guided a lot by their obsession and fascination with a couple of children's books, the Madeline series from Ludwig Bemelmans, and then The Red Balloon, which is also a film by Albert Lamorisse. And so exploring all those places really just kind of opened up the city in a new way to me. And on the last day of that trip, we went into a little English language bookstore that was kind of in the process of closing down, where it appeared, we didn't know that at first, but the place was kind of a very picturesque mess. And as we were checking out, the woman took a long look at us and said, do you think you'd like to buy the store? And she was half joking, but only half. And she thought we might be the right sort of family because our daughters clearly love books and I love books. And I was a writer. And so she thought we might be a good match. And for a long afternoon as we walked away from that store, we wondered if we might be a good match. We were trying to calculate exactly how long it would take us to lose our entire life savings in Paris. And we thought we would have a good 8 months before it all went south. Many people subsequently offered to work for us for free in the store, but no one ever offered to give us money to, to buy the store. And so we didn't buy it. But in this new book, I do get a bookstore in Paris. And so that's just one of the wonderful ways that fiction opens up new worlds for you. You can kind of like write your way there. A little bit like, was it Milo in The Phantom Toll
Booth? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kind of drew himself forward. So I think that's, I'm looking forward to that too. Or Harold.
Harold, exactly.
Harold in the Purple Crayon. Yeah. He drew the path forward, and I was doing that in this book as well.
You mentioned The Red Balloon, and I certainly remember the film The Red Balloon when I was young. I had these kind of, there's sepia-toned memories, partly because I'm sure the print I saw of the film was so faded in some at some level. But as you describe, the Red Balloon figures prominently in this book. It occurs to me that maybe the memories aren't so much faded colors as it was that was what the film actually looked like. It is a Paris that is very gray except for this balloon.
It is. It's fascinating, the story of the Red Balloon itself, because it came out in the mid-50s and it won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, which is ironic because it's probably only 30 words of dialogue in the whole piece. It's only 30 minutes long. And it's hypnotized a generations of American kids, especially in the 70s and 80s when thousands of copies were distributed in American classrooms and people would always watch it during recess. And, you know, it sounds like you're like me. It was just absolutely captivated by this Paris. And I've always thought it was a strange film to captivate you by because it's a pretty bleak and gritty and gray Paris. But I do think that for a certain sort of artistically minded soul, that it kind of appeals to us all the more because it feels real in a way. It feels like we're not seeing Paris through rose-colored glasses. We're actually getting some sort of a real Paris. But of course, it's just another version of a Paris myth. And so, if anything, that kind of notion of kind of a gray and gritty Paris also appeals to some sort of deep part of us that we want it to be. You know, we want to be the one to kind of go over there and fix it. And I think that the way the Red Balloon haunts people, I think is in part because of that. It kind of plucks some sort of longing deep inside us, which matches that gray and red landscape.
And in contrast, there's the Paris of the Madeleine books,
right,
which is much,
much sunnier.
Yeah,
and like literally sunnier because he's got a sun in a lot of shots. Although to his credit, he does paint a page or two of them wandering through the rain. But those are kids' books. That's for a younger set. Although really not. I mean, The Red Balloon it goes pretty young too. But so the Madeleine series is, you know, to my mind, it's just kind of like painted with a lot more joie de vivre, I guess we would say. There's a lot more dash and color and style, and it's sunny. And I think between the two of them, between Lamorisse and Bemelmans, between The Red Balloon and the Madeleine books. I mean, that's how kids went to France. I think that's how a lot of people still go to France. And I mean that metaphorically, but also like literally, like I think that those books take many, many people to France just because they're transported there. And so it's two different ways of looking at a city is how I claim it in the book. And so my book kind of joins that conversation where, you know, this young woman from the east side of Milwaukee is going off looking for her husband who's just abjectly disappeared from their house one day. And she gets some clues that lead her to believe that they might be going, that he might have disappeared to Paris. Other people think he just disappeared into the lake because he left absolutely no trace. So
he's kind of a tortured writer, if I can call him that.
Which is odd because I don't know any tortured writers myself, and I certainly am not one myself. But there's a certain type, and he's a tortured writer and who also wrote children's literature. And so he was a big fan of both of these artists. And what he liked about them, which is kind of what I like about Lumrys and Bellamy's, is both of them were really complicated individuals. And so is Leah, the narrator of my book. She finds her husband Robert's pretty complicated. So off they go to Paris to kind of search for him. But then Paris itself turns out not to be quite what they expected, and they discover all sorts of things that surprise them along the way.
How did Leah emerge as your narrative voice?
That was a really interesting process. This was the book started a totally different way. I had written it in third person. It was from the husband's perspective. And it was there was a long part in Milwaukee. And then one day I was sitting down to write and I stared at my computer for a long time. I'd reached kind of a pause point in the narrative. And something that I often tell my students, I teach writing, one thing I often tell my students is if you ever get blocked, just open up another door and try it a different way and maybe try switching point of view. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that. Today I'll write in the wife's point of view just to kind of see what she's thinking about. Well, it turns out she was thinking about a lot. That day she thought about 1,000 words and the next day 5,000. Then suddenly I had about 25,000 words all in the wife's perspective, and I thought, she is the most interesting character I've got, and she also has a lot more to say. And so I just hung on for the ride at that point. So she, very much a scene stealer, she wandered into the text and took it over. And a couple 100,000 words later, she's in charge.
And as we get to know her, she has always wanted to go to Paris, but the only Paris she has been to in the past is Paris, Wisconsin. Both Paris, Wisconsin's.
Yes.
At a very early, maybe ideal moment in her marriage to Roberts.
That's one of the things that fascinated me is that we do have a Paris, Wisconsin, just south of Milwaukee, actually. And I think that it's not far from where the new Foxconn plant will be. It's just off to the west of 94 if you're heading down to Chicago. And then there's another Paris, Wisconsin. At least the maps say that there's another Paris, Wisconsin out in the southwest of the state. But I couldn't find a sign out there. One of the things that struck me about both Paris, Wisconsins, and for that matter, these notion of all the Parises across the United States, there are more Parises in the United States than any other foreign capital. And I feel like this is a place that people have been dreaming of for a while. So there's a Paris, Wisconsin. There's certainly a Paris, Texas. There's a Paris, New York. Supposedly, actually, the Paris, Wisconsin was named for the Paris, New York. I like that they weren't dreaming too big down there. They didn't want to presume to be named after Paris, France, but Paris, New York was a safe bet. But it just reminded me of kind of the thing that we do, which is to dream of being in a different spot, but then somehow to try and recreate and tend to that myth in our own backyard. And so I was fascinated by that. At one point, the characters take a world tour, but they do it all within the state of Wisconsin. So they go down from Luxembourg up north of Milwaukee. And
Belgium's up there as well.
Yeah, Belgium and Cuba City and Paris and the other Paris. And, of course, there's New Berlin. So there's all these places you can go. And I just like this idea that people are kind of constantly tending to these stories outside themselves. And it turned out to be one of the things that my book was about.
Paris, the one in France anyway, is the setting for so many great works of literature. How well do you feel like you had to know it to credibly represent it, to do it justice as it is, as opposed to this, you know, idealized Madeline version that maybe we got when we were 5 or 6?
That was the most terrifying aspect of the whole thing, was because I was entering my first novel was set in Alaska, and fewer people know Alaska as well as Paris. And Paris belongs to everyone, particularly Parisians. And so it was a big challenge for me to get right. And I have not lived in Paris. I visited many times, and I visited a few times more during the drafting of this book. And so every day that I would go to work on this, I would try to go to Paris in the sense that before I started my writing day, I would start with some language review, like French language review, just to kind of get French in my head. I listened to these wonderful sound artists. Luckily, the internet is a wide enough place that there are people who literally just wander cities, particularly Paris, with a ambient mic on and just capture the sounds of the scene. And so I would put my headphones on. I would download a 2-hour file of someone who was walking across Paris. That Paris does not fill with wheezing accordions and people selling flowers.
It's not all Edith Piaf songs.
No, it isn't. I mean, there's a couple people, but otherwise it's not. It's, you know, it's Chilean pan flutes and it's that two-tone European siren that sounds so distinctive. It's motos buzzing by. It's tiny little diesel trucks. It's people kind of shouting as they try the buses that honk and horn. And I realize, and that just put me in mind of like, I want to make sure that the Paris that is here is real in the sense that it's an actual like urban place that people will recognize. So it's interesting. I had some people in Paris read the book, and it was interesting that they would disagree and agree over different things. Some of them would say, this is exactly like Paris, and then other would say, like, it was not. They were talking about the exact same thing. And I thought, well, you know what? I think I've got it right then. If they're disagreeing, then all the facets of Paris have been covered.
Well, and your book is being distributed and published in a variety of places, but at its heart, you know, this is an American who's experienced. I mean, Leah is really going there for the first time, and so this is an American experiencing it versus a German person versus an English person.
Exactly, and versus a French person.
Right.
So it's a very – and so I make no claims for a universal Paris experience. I think it's very authentic to her experience, and I think her expat experience over there is to kind of see Paris through a very – in some ways, narrow window, because she hasn't mastered French yet. She spends the book trying to learn it better, which is not unlike myself. And
her daughters get it faster than
she does. Her daughters get it faster than she does, which they assure me up at the Alliance Française, where I've been studying, that happens very familiar. The kids get it, and the parents trail along behind. And so that's been my experience. But in her case, I think she also finds that you know, expat life can be really lonely when you don't share the language, and life in a big city can be really challenging, especially when navigating the bureaucracy of a place like Paris. And so I think that was part of what I wasn't attempting to provide a real Paris so much as I was attempting to provide a Paris that was true to her outlook.
And at one level, she is there because she is looking for her husband, but she is looking for something bigger, too.
She is. I think she's looking for a lost piece of herself, not to sound too romantic about it. But I think that when her husband disappears, she realizes that more is at stake than her marriage. I think she's also realizing that her own definition of what she thought and life was going to be like, adulthood, parenthood, and what sort of dreams that she has. It's something that she goes through the book trying to sort through. Like, what does it mean to be a mom? What does it mean to be a bookstore owner? What does it mean to be an American in Paris? She's very conscious of her nationality and status a lot of times. And then what does it mean when a place like Paris or the life you thought you were going to lead doesn't exactly turn out to square with that? How do you navigate the gap between the reality and myth that you had? I think it's one of the things that really obsesses her in the book.
Well, Liam Callanan, I will have you know that as I was reading this book, I was busy pricing out flights to Paris. So job well done.
Oh, excellent. Good. I should put a coupon in the back for that. It really is. It's people. I've become a new booster for Paris, and I think that not that Paris needed much more boosting, but I think people think of it as it's unreachable. It's quite reachable, especially for people who have tuned into Lake Effect from the Milwaukee Reason, because you can get to Chicago and you can be in Paris in 8 hours. And folks, when you tune into the show next, you should be in Paris. You can also catch WWM in Paris on the internet, so you won't be that disconnected.
But you should at least stick around for the reading at Boswell.
Absolutely. Please come April 3rd to the reading at Boswell.
Liam, thanks. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Merci.
Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan's latest novel is called Paris by the Book. It comes out tomorrow. He'll read from it and talk more tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company in an event that also helps celebrate Boswell's 9th anniversary.
But if you just can't wait, here is a little excerpt from Paris by the Book that Liam read for us from the opening.
This is Leah speaking, so you have to imagine a 40-something woman who's owning a bookstore in Paris and has lost her husband and is not sure where her kids are right now.
I've long considered the front of our bookstore a trap, one carefully set. This is as it must be. Although we are in the wearyingly popular Marais district, we are in the lower Marais, closer to the Seine but farther from the falafel stands and creperies, the pedestrian streets and thus the crowds and thus customers. One side of our block is almost entirely taken up with the blank back wall of a monastery, which may or may not be occupied. Despite all the bells, I've never seen a monk on the sidewalk. Opposite the monastery, a succession of shops like ours, peering out from the ground floors of anonymous, flat-front buildings in various shades of cream, forever wizening yellow. High above, zinc roofs slowly bruise black. Windows shrug away shutters. Here and there appear flowers or their remains. So too wrought iron railings or their remains. And our store, bright red, like an apple, a womb.
Writer Liam Callanan reading from Paris by the Book.
We'll take one more break, and then contributor Robert Cohen muses about the difficulties of performing all of the Bach cello suites in the same evening. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Each month, contributor and cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about the life of a professional classical musician.
Well, this month, Robert takes a break from preparing for a monumental musical marathon, performing all six of Johann Sebastian Bach's suites for unaccompanied cello in one evening. Hello, Robert. It is always wonderful to hear you, if not see you. How are you doing?
Very well. I'm sorry I'm not seeing you as well.
I know. It's always so much fun when you're actually in the studio. But the magic of technology allows us to continue our conversations. And I wanted to actually go back to the beginning of this segment, and every segment that we've done, I think from the beginning, is that particular piece of music that you perform. It is one of the Bach suites for unaccompanied cello. And it's part of the cello repertoire that it's huge, it's monumental. It is just one of those sets of pieces that is just so magnificent and I imagine so difficult.
Yes, and you know, and so profoundly important to all cellists and even, you know, to me when I really first discovered them as a child, and my teacher William Pleath introduced them to me in a way that I understood what an incredible challenge they would be and how spiritual they were and inspiring. And I was really hooked even from the age of 10 on how I could manage to play Bach suites, because it's a mountain to climb, really, to play these six suites. And it is a journey. I mean, each suite is kind of further up the hill, and the sixth suite is really extraordinarily complex and fiendishly difficult to play. And each suite has six movements, a prelude to start with, and then five movements which are based on Baroque dance ideas. But somehow what Bach did was to write, I think, music which described the key of each suite. So the first suite in G major is an open and beautiful, calm key. And everybody knows this suite when they hear it. It appeals to us in a very natural way. Thank you. moves to the next suite in a different key. And throughout the suites, he sort of explains so much about the key and therefore something about how the key creates character and mood and almost like a person. Each suite is almost like an individual. And at the same time, you know, this single instrument playing the music for a choir, he's writing four parts all the time. The line you play is a little bit from the soprano, then a little bit from the bass, and switching over to the alto. So you're playing the music that would be written for a choir, but just on the cello. And that's an incredible challenge and incredibly complex to understand in some ways as you're learning it. And I knew as I was learning it as a young person that this was going to be a lifelong adventure. And it certainly has been amazing.
It is amazing to listen to. And the journey that we, the audience, go through with you is a profound one also. And I hadn't thought of it in terms of each suite being like a person, but it really is like that. And you get to know who this person is. And of course, they're all Bach. You know, I always think of it as they're all pieces of him that he put in these suites. And so you're getting to know a different aspect of him through each suite.
And there's, I think, of course, with Bach, you're dealing with the master of all masters of structure and architecture. And that structure of each movement and each suite is so extraordinary, but it gives you this boundless freedom within it to feel the intense emotions, the purity and the majesty of the music, the simplicity and the complexity all the time. You know, there's nothing that which has this power for cello that the six suites have. And sometimes when I'm programming them, I choose the character of the suite that I want to go into the program with other pieces of music. But it's always amazing to play a whole program of Bach suites. And in fact, even more than that, to play all of the Bach suites in a sort of marathon evening, which is 3.5 hours of non-stop playing. And that is an extraordinary experience. And it's one that I'm about to embark on, actually. You know, I haven't done it so many times in my life, but the first time I decided to do it was because my wife was running the London Marathon and she was preparing for that. And she was going to raise money for a children's charity. And I decided that really I should do my bit as well and support the charity with a kind of musical marathon. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to play all six suites in one very extended concert. And it was an extraordinary experience and enormously demanding for concentration, for my stamina and physical endurance, actually. And probably most of all, the kind of emotional strength to deal with so much all at once. Six suites are almost like, you feel almost like you're explaining Bach's entire life. And yet, actually, it was all written within about 5 years in his middle age. But that's 300 years ago. We're at the anniversary of this monumental creation. And nothing until the 20th century was written for cello that had any significance compared to this.
Do you think he intended for the six suites to be performed in a marathon like that?
That's a very good question. I have no idea. But if you think about the St. Matthew Passion, for instance, that's however long it is, 3 hours long. So he was obviously used to writing things which were monumental in that way and which did take an enormous amount of time. So who knows? I mean, it was only that cellists discovering it very much later on, Pablo Casals being the kind of really the most important person to bring them to the world's notice in the 20th century. He started to play them and then they started to get recorded. And the recordings, I think people find when they listen to the Bach suites that they are so human and so moving that I've often had to be quite honest, Bonnie, I've had people write to me telling me what my recording of Bach suites has done for them, where they were lying in hospital or they chose them for some very specific reason. They used them to recover from some awful incident or from somebody dying, or just as literally as something that uplifts them on a daily basis. And you can understand that. I think they do have an amazing impact.
Again, I keep using the word profound because I find them profoundly moving. And you mentioned earlier on, you know, the fact that they are spiritual, because I always think of that with Bach, too, because his faith was so strong and everything that he wrote was in service to that. And I always think that there's some sort of ache in his music, a longing.
And you know, when he wrote the cello suites, this was his first time away from writing for the church. He was writing for the royal court. He no longer needed to write music for religious ceremonies and so on. So he was actually free to write non-religious music. And these suites came out of that period, as do the violin solo sonatas and things. So the spirituality is probably quite different from the period before. And yet, as you say, there is something which is timeless. And when you hear, for instance, the Saraband, which is the kind of most heartfelt, deeply moving movement from the fifth suite in C minor, which is a tragic key and a tragic character, when you hear that movement, which I sometimes play as an encore after, maybe after a concerto or in a recital, it is so timeless that very often people who haven't heard it before will come and say, did somebody just write that? Is that a new piece? You know, who's it written by? They can't quite believe you can tell them, no, that was Johann Sebastian Bach and it was written 300 years ago. It is that timeless and that extraordinary and modern and inventive. And even just the movement from one note to another is breathtaking. And of course, we know that about Bach, but when you experience it like that, it just blows you away.
So what is the reason you are embarking on the marathon this time?
Well, I was invited to do it, knowing that it was around the 300th anniversary of his suites. And, you know, the subject came up and we were discussing Bach, and I thought, yes, I should do it again. It's just an experience that you never really forget. I guess the same as running a marathon. You will never forget what you've had to go through. And the preparation for it is also really extraordinary, because you're having to remind yourself how to stay focused in this kind of way of concentrating of this entire Bach world, and how to stay in it every split second for the entire 3.5 hours, because if you don't stay in that mode, you can get lost so easily. Because, as I said, it's like playing music for a choir, but you're on your own. So you're having to jump from one part to another. And without the real concentration, without the real sense of where you are all the time, you can literally just turn left instead of turn right and end up crashing badly and being out of the mood. And so the training for that sort of concentration every day, working really carefully with the music, physically even thinking about how you're going to manage. Nobody's throwing you a cup of water every few minutes as you go by to help you. You're just absorbed totally. And there's no other time that you play for so long. I mean, not when you're the only voice. You are literally the only voice. And so psychologically and musically and physically, you have to be so attuned. You have to be tuned in, and you have to have that kind of stamina and endurance and the emotional strength to go through it. And also your audience has to be, you know, absorbed in it the whole time as well. But, you know, as we've been saying, that shouldn't be the problem. I mean, the audience gets involved in this music so easily, despite how complex and profound it is. It speaks so clearly.
Well, Robert Cohen, as always, it is such a pleasure to talk with you. Best of luck with everything, and we will talk next month.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Lovely to talk to you.
Contributor Robert Cohen talks about the life of a professional touring classical musician each month on our On That Note segment. You can listen back to past episodes at WUWM.com. And that brings us to the end of Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.